Leaders Questions. Thanks to Cisco Systems and Exertis Ireland. Providing a secure, intelligent platform for digital business. Visit intelligentit.ie.
This podcast is brought to you by Cisco Systems and Exertis Ireland. Cisco EasyLease 0% financing provides an attractive alternative for your valuable cash. You can spread the cost of your complete Cisco project at true 0% interest over 3 years. Don't believe us? The EasyLease offer is available in 27 countries across a mere. To hear more, visit intelligentit.ie. Welcome along to another Leaders Questions with Stuart Lancaster. Our guest this week is stateside. His name is John Gordon. He's a best-selling author of books like The Energy Bus, The Power of Positive Leadership, and You Win in the Locker Room First. John, a very good evening to you. How are you doing?
Good to be with you guys. Doing great.
I guess it's actually morning where you are. It's evening where we are. Well, look, you're very welcome to the show. Before I actually speak to you a little bit more, I'm going to ask Stuart why we're talking to you, because you guys have a bit of a connection.
Yeah, I mean, the way it came about, actually, was I was asked to do a podcast for a guy called Michael Gervais in America. And I think it came because I did some work with Atlanta Falcons and Dan Quinn, the American football coach. I assume that's where it came from. Anyway, so it led me to the podcast, Michael's podcast. And I was then drawn to other podcasts. And I listened to John's. And I thought, that is so much in keeping with what I believe in. So I then bought his book, You Win the Locker Room First, read the book, and then went back to Michael and said, do you have a connection, a way I could connect with John? So I then dropped John a line. We had a Skype call, which was a great conversation for me. And then obviously on the back of that, you and I have started talking about doing this show where we can invite people in from people I've met who I think would add value to leaders, you know, in Ireland and wherever. And hence here we are. So, hi, John.
How you doing, Stuart? Good to see you again.
Yeah, good, thanks.
So the Atlanta Falcons is obviously very important, I think, in your life as well, John. We might get to that in a minute. But before we do, your own backstory is pretty remarkable, how you got to the point where you are now a best-selling author and a motivational speaker for some of the biggest sports teams and companies in the world. Can you take us back to the bit where you realized that that's what you wanted to do?
Yes, I mean, I was a competitive athlete. I played lacrosse at Division I lacrosse at Cornell University. Played sports my entire life, so always had that background. Then, in my late 20s, early 30s, after working in business, opening up restaurants, working for .com, my life started to fall apart. I was really miserable, negative. My wife and I were fighting all the time. And it was during that time where my wife said, I had enough. I've had enough of your negativity. I love you, but I'm not going to spend my life with someone who makes me so miserable. You need to change. And so I knew I needed to change because she said so. And I also knew that I needed to change. So that started me on this journey of saying, okay, what am I born to do? Why am I here? And writing and speaking came to me. I never thought I would do this, ever. But it came to me. I said, okay, well, what am I going to write and speak about? Well, I want to be more positive. And so positivity became not just my learning, it became, my calling and what I was meant to do to share with others. And then from writing these books that I wrote The Energy Bus. The Energy Bus became, well-known pretty quickly after Jack Del Rio used it with the Jacksonville Jaguars in 2007. It came out in 2007. And other coaches started to read this book. I started to be invited to speak to teams. And that began this journey of now working with teams and the leaders. And then I realized, it's not just positivity of what I'm here to do. It's about developing positive leaders and then building positive teams.
The best bit, one of the best bits when we had the conversation and when I read the book was actually about the story of how the book became successful. Because actually, it wasn't that easy, was it? I mean, when you read about it, I remember you saying you went on this book tour and you went around. How actually did it become successful? Because that's the bit that inspired me, really. The fact that you were, you gave up your job and, you wrote this book and then no one seemed to want to buy it. And then suddenly, just through sheer perseverance, you managed to get it off the ground and look where you are.
Yeah, it was all grit. So I wrote the book. 3.5 weeks I wrote it. It was just pure inspiration. And now I start pitching it. I start putting it out there. I found an agent. It was rejected by over 30 publishers. So no one saw my vision. No one liked it. And I remember my agent telling me, just give up. It's not going to happen. But I couldn't give up because I really felt like I wrote something that could make a difference. And so kept on putting it out there, kept on believing and hoping and praying. And finally, John Wally and Sons agreed to take it on. Shannon Vargo read the book. She was an assistant at the time. She wanted to do the book. Her boss said, don't do it. If it doesn't go well, it could be your career. But she agreed to take it on. So now it's coming out. And I remember just being really excited that it's coming out. I asked a friend, what should I do? He said, pray. So I prayed for it to be a bestseller. And it came out. It was a bestseller in Korea. South Korea, of course. And it was a huge hit in South Korea. But not one bookstore in the United States would carry this book. So I went on a 28-city tour, you know, paid for by myself. My publisher wouldn't even support me. I didn't have a lot of money. I had some restaurants, and I had sold these restaurants to hopefully focus on my passion and purpose of writing and speaking. My wife was terrified that I sold our restaurants and our livelihood, but I felt like I needed to focus on this 100%. And so I had a little money, not a ton, but I went on this tour, paid for by myself. And I went from city to city. There were 5 people in one city, 10 people in another. And the most people we had were 100 people in Des Moines, Iowa. They thought Jeff Gordon, the race car driver, was coming, you know. And so that's a true story. That's not just a joke. They really thought coming in. That's why they showed up. And, you know, I didn't know what was going to happen. But I got back from the tour. I was exhausted and tired. But I gave everything I had. And that's when Jack Del Rio got a hold of the book, and different people started reading the book, and teachers and coaches. And next thing you know, bookstores did start carrying it, maybe about a year later, but it didn't become a bestseller for like 5 years. And that was 2007. So here we are 11 years later. It sold over 1.5 million copies, you know, around the world. And it's more popular now than it was 5 years ago, more popular 10 years ago. And so I don't take credit for it at all. It's just something that I've been passionate about and sharing out there and believing in the message. And just everywhere I go, I just share it. And I know that, you know, when I started this, my vision was to inspire and empower as many people as possible, one person at a time. One person.
So the reason I'm smiling so much is because I guess in a similar way, I wanted to try and do the same thing. So I've created my own website, and it's a coaching one. It's got a leadership club and a coaching club. And so I put a load of content on, a load of rugby coaching, skills and drills and all sorts of stuff, and a load of leadership content on how you build great teams and communicate and all that sort of stuff. And I've got the Google Analytics, where you can look at how many people see your website. So anyway, I didn't have the login for a while. I thought, you know, there must be quite a few people looking at it. And anyway, so it sort of ranges from 20 to 10 to 5. So I need to do a better job at promoting it. But I feel very much like John at the moment. I've got a long way to go.
You need Jack Del Rio. Yeah.
I need Jack Del Rio.
But again, it just starts that way, one person at a time. I joke, when I started, Stuart, I would say I'm internationally known because I had one friend in London. And so I was internationally known. But, you know, I recently spoke in Ireland. I was in Ireland in Dublin speaking to Dell. And I thought, okay, well, now I am international.
It worked. Can I, I ask you why it rang a bell for Jack Del Rio. Why did it ring a bell for you when you're reading the book? What is it when you're going through the stuff that is like, yeah, this makes sense to me?
It's the communicate to connect. It's how you build communicate and commitment, how you build commitment within teams. So, you know, it goes back to the previous conversations we've had, you know, with other people where we talk about, you know, building teams is obviously about what you do and how you do it, but it's the why you do it, and creating those sense of connections between you and the players that you're coaching or the management team that you're working with. And once you get that sense of commitment, I think John talks about caring, and there's other little things he puts in his book. He talks about energy vampires in teams, which I think we've talked about before, different way of framing it. And so there's just so many little things. I mean, my guide to a book is, when I read a book, how many times do I draw a line under something? And I go through John's book and I think, there's a lot of lines in this. So it clearly did the job for me, and very similar to my philosophy, I guess.
When Jack Del Rio was coming and taking your book, what was he taking out of it, John? Why do you think he was drawn to it? And why have so many sports teams and coaches found in your books stuff that resonates with them?
Well, I think it's because we're like-minded. Like, Stuart and I are like-minded. So when he's reading this book, he's like, yes, I believe that. I need that. I'm not saying anything that's, you know, out of the ordinary. I'm not sharing rocket science. I'm sharing the basic principles. And I think great coaches like Stuart, they get it and they realize, okay, these are really simple ideas, but we can act on them. And so with Jack Del Rio, he really got the negative piece out of it, the energy vampire piece. I remember him sitting down with me and saying, you know, I've been allowing these negative energy vampires to get me down. And I realized reading your book that I got to be more positive than the negativity that I face. And I can't allow their negativity to impact me. And we got to deal with the negativity. Like the energy bus talks about confronting the energy vampires. You Win in the Locker Room First talks about confronting the energy vampires. Just wrote a new book, The Power of Positive Leadership, how to deal with negativity. Positive leaders don't just focus on the positive. This is reality. We deal with the negative that exists. So I think I'm speaking the language that every coach and team understands, and they know what they need to do. And then this puts it in the language in a very simple way that allows them to take action on it. But it was really Mike Smith who actually was on that staff with Jack Del Rio. He was the defensive coordinator. And he was the one who actually gave it to Jack and said, Reed, do this. Well, then Mike Smith became the coach of the Atlanta Falcons. He was there 7 years before Dan Quinn got there. And Mike's the one who really, you know, embraced it in a big way. And then Mike and I wrote You Win in the Locker Room First together about like what went right with him at the Falcons, but then what went wrong? Why was he fired? Why did Dan Quinn have to come in as the coach? And so we talk about that, a very refreshing path of, you know, what he did wrong as a leader, but what he did right, and then these seven C's to build a winning team.
I think it's always the stuff that you have the honesty about your appraisal of why things failed that is so compelling for us on the outside, because everybody who follows the NFL or the Falcons will have seen what happened to the team and they'll have their assumptions about why it failed. But for them to put that down in a book and explain, okay, well, this is the nuances of, these are the decisions that we got wrong, the ones that we would go back and change if we could, but that's not how life works. And I think that's probably where this whole idea of the iterative process of becoming a leader is something that we have to continuously embrace and talk about.
Yeah. I mean, certainly for me, you know, we had great success coaching the England team, but equally, you know, on the biggest stage, the failure. And what helps me in a certain way deal with it is helping other teams learn from what I could have done better. Now, I haven't written a book because I don't feel it's the right place or the right time to do that, but I'm more than happy to share what I learned with teams and organisations to help them improve and learn from the things I possibly could have done better as the leader or what could have happened in the environment. And we're talking about, you know, the most incredible pressure on a team, a home World Cup. You know, it's third biggest sporting event in the world. So, you know, it has helped me deal with it by sharing what I've learned. And I think there's a lot of lessons that hopefully I've passed on.
Did you read You Win in the Locker Room First after the World Cup?
Yeah, it was after. Yeah, no, it was. I read it less than 6 months ago. I think I'd need to check, John, with you. But I think one thing that Mike said in the book about he could have fought for the culture harder. Would that be right?
Yep. He said that he after their loss to San Francisco in the NFC Championship game, you know, they were one play away from going to the Super Bowl, the biggest, you know, game in America. They became an organization that was focused on the outcome and the results and the expectations of the world and of others and their ownership. And they got away from all the little things that made them successful and their culture. And so Mike says he allowed it to happen. And as all this pressure was coming in from the outside, he should have built the culture even more and focused even more on the culture. But he got caught up in, if I just win, they'll leave me alone. And that's where we fall short and we go down the wayside when that happens. No, we got to continue to invest and build the culture, doing the little things that got us there. I love what you said, Stuart, about, you know, the world stage. There's nothing more pressurized, nothing more like stressful than what you do as a leader. That's why I love coaches. I love what Stuart has to deal with on a daily basis. And I admire them so much because there's nothing more pressure in the world. Like when I fail on a test or when I fail on a talk, you know, okay, maybe 500 people will be there, maybe 1,000 at the most. When you fail on world stage, millions see your fail. That's rough.
That is rough.
It is rough, and it's it's rough. It's not just on you as well. It's rough on, you know, the family and the friends and everyone around you. There's absolutely no doubt. But it's also what you sign up to. Oops, sorry. It's what you sign up to. And I think from my point of view, you know, I knew when I took on the job, you know, it was there was a lot of work to do on the cultural side of things and get the team in the right place. And it was a race against time to get the team ready. But I knew that the consequences would be huge if we didn't achieve it.
The fans don't see you as human either. The fans forget that you're a human being.
Yeah.
They see that as a figure, almost like a TV character. They don't see that you're a real person with real feelings, with a family that is really deeply hurt when you don't succeed or when you're facing criticism.
Yeah.
John, your philosophy is obviously based around positivity. How did that work with the Falcons when things were... when that culture was dissipating, when it was just slipping through the fingers of the team and the group, did you have to teach them to think about the potential for failure? Or how does that actually work? How do you deal with that failure?
Well, I spoke to the Los Angeles Rams this year. The Los Angeles Rams were 4-12 last year and 11-5 this year. When Mike Smith and Matt Ryan took over, Matt Ryan was the rookie quarterback, Mike Smith the rookie coach, they were 4-12 and they went to 11-5. So right away, we turn around the culture. So am I the reason for their success? Of course not. I spoke to the Cleveland Browns 2 years ago. And, you know anything about the Cleveland Browns? I mean, they are just, you know, a horrible team in the United States. They have yet to win. Their culture is horrible. I mean, it's just really bad. But I spoke to that team. And what I always say, it's never the talk. It's never the book. It's really always the leadership and the culture. And it's reinforcing that message of positivity. So when I speak and I work with the team, I'm sharing the principles. I'm talking about the standards. And then it's up to the coach and the team and the leadership to rise up to meet those standards. And so what I noticed, that there was a building of the culture. There was a lot of optimism, belief. And then after that loss that we just talked about, after that loss, I noticed that they said that if we don't make it to the playoffs, if we don't make it to the Super Bowl, this season's a failure. And I heard them talk about that during the season one time after a game, and I was like, oh no, oh no. Like, the messaging was not there. What I had talked about in training camp was the complete opposite of that. And I knew right then and there that it was not going to be good. It was not going to be good. Now, they also had injuries. They had a lot of injuries. And John Madden said that, you know, winning is a great deal. It covers up what stinks about your team. So when you're winning, you don't really notice that things are bad. But when you're losing, it all becomes exposed. Well, their injuries, the culture, and everything really came to a head that second bad year. And that's when he was fired after that. I truly believe they should have kept him. And I really believe he would have turned it around with, again, the draft picks, with healthy players and so forth. But he didn't get that chance. But we also talked about the fact that he got fired was a great option to write this book that has helped so many people. So we really believe there's a reason for everything. But I did notice that it wasn't about optimism. It was really about they were too attached to the outcome, and they were worried about the failure rather than attacking the process. I just spoke to the Los Angeles Dodgers. I've worked with the Los Angeles Dodgers, the baseball team, for the last 3 years. They lost the World Series last year in Game 7. And I talked to them about that, and I shared the difference between the Falcons and then the great teams that lose a big game and come back and win the championship the following year. And the biggest difference is they're not defending a position. They're not defending a ranking. They're not defending expectations. They're attacking and they're obsessed with the process of just like going in there and just dominating every game to ultimately win. But it's not about the outcome. They're just focused so much on that process.
Did the England team get too wrapped up in that fear or the...
You know, John said something really interesting then that resonated with me about the actual game, about how staying on task and with the process during the game. So there was a moment in the game, we were 22-12 up. I think we conceded a penalty, 22-15. Wales scored a try out of nothing, really. I can't remember the exact score, but certainly they scored a try out of nothing, and suddenly the game had gone from us winning 22-12 to 25-all. And I could see the players and feel the players, even from where I was sat in the stand, thinking about what had happened in the past, i.e., oh my God, they've just scored that try out of nothing. And the consequences of that is we might not win this game. Mm. And so then you go away from the process and you're worrying about the past or the future. And that moment and the next 10 minutes, we had opportunities to close out the game, to win the game. And even when we were pushed into touch and we could have had it, we had another line out, we then knocked the ball on from that line out. So staying in the moment is absolutely key to high performance. And we talk about redhead and bluehead. So redhead being you are distracted, you are thinking about the past or worrying about the future, you've made a mistake, and that bluehead is in the moment. And what we're trying to do is try to make sure the players, the team stay in the blue and the players stay in the blue. And if you see someone in the red, then you say, hey, get back in the blue. And just trying to give them triggers and little things that they can do. And I know the New Zealand rugby team in 2007, they had a very similar moment in the quarterfinal of the Rugby World Cup when they lost against France. And they employed this company, which helped them on that process, which certainly helped them in the lead-up to the 2011 World Cup final win, which they won 8-7 at home.
In that last moment, in that last play, when they're continuing to recycle the ball, apparently messages are coming down, exit, 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 and McCall's like, no, I'm very confident that we're going to be able to continue. And that's the he had decided that they had the blue heads.
Yeah.
The coaches had the red heads, and he was just going to stay and do it.
Surely.
And, you know, there's still tension to this day between Henry and McCall when they talk about that moment. But
I mean, talk about the Ireland rugby team in the grand, you know, the France game. You know, 41 phases and a drop goal. I mean, that was unbelievable, you know, staying in the moment and not panicking under pressure.
John, how do you coach that? And particularly, how do you coach it in an American football team when you know that there's going to be a play that goes against you, there'll be a turnover, a fumble? Like, when you're talking to somebody as big as the Atlanta Falcons, particularly in training camp when there could be 90 bodies, how do you get those guys to focus?
Yeah, you're just sharing the message and really sharing truth with them. You share these principles of truth that you know works. And the best way to be in the moment, to be honest, is to love it. You know, fear is going to come in, and fear causes you to look outside. And what we teach them is don't look outside, look inside. Outside is the noise, the worry, the expectation, the crowd, the fear of failure. That's all outside. Inside is your love, your passion, your purpose, your joy for the game. And if you love it, you won't fear it. So it's really helping them understand that when they are loving the playing, when they're loving the moment, loving the competition, they're not going to be in fear. Love casts out fear. So if you love it, you won't fear it. So there's really a lot of power in that. It's helping them understand inside out, like don't focus on the outside, get back to inside. You have red and blue, right? Or, you know, that's the same type of thing. Are we outside or are we inside? Get back to inside. You know, stop thinking about the outside. Just play. We create inside out. That's where the power is. I was with a NBA team. I was walking across the court, and there was a head coach there and a superstar player. And they said, hey, John, what's a bigger impact on a team? Home field advantage in baseball or home court advantage in basketball? So I thought for a moment. I said, well, what do you think? And they each had different reasons. And I said, neither. When you know the outside is just noise and it has no power over you, we create inside out. I shared them the powers on the inside. That's where we create from. That the outside has no power. It's all about inside out. And the superstar player said, that's what I think. He said 98% of the guys in the league, 98% believe in home court advantage. So it affects them. I know it isn't true. So I just go do what I do and play my game. Think about that. 98% are believing the lie that something outside can impact them. So it does. They're believing in a lie. He goes, I know the truth. So he lives the truth, and there's power in truth. So I just go play my game. It's why he's a superstar. And so the more we can teach them that mindset. So I'm not teaching strategy. I don't believe in strategy. I teach truth. And then from truth, you then find the strategy that works for you in that moment.
One of the themes we've been talking about over the course of the podcast is we explain why you get people to examine the reasons why they're doing something, either as an individual or as a group. And from that, everything else kind of flows. And that's effectively what you're talking about, the truth. So I guess, again,
it's a next play mentality. So we also say, you know, next play. Like, it doesn't matter what happened in the last play. Next play. Next play. That's a very popular term here in the States. Next play. So in basketball, especially, like, whatever happened on the last play is the last play. So it's about just the next play. When I was visiting the baseball teams during spring training last year, I spoke to like four different teams because they're all in the same area in Phoenix during spring training. And they kept on saying, you know, John, it's hard to stay positive because baseball is a game of failure. If you're a Hall of Famer, you're failing 2 out of 3 times. If you're an average player, you're failing 3 out of 4 times. It's a game of failure. I said, I don't see it that way. I told the teams, no, change your mindset. It's not a game of failure. It's a game of opportunity because every at bat is an opportunity to make the next one great. So it's letting go of the past, next play, next moment, because that last play is not going to have any bearing on your next one unless you let it affect you.
This podcast is brought to you by Cisco Systems and Exertus Ireland. Cisco EasyLease 0% financing allows you to bundle the Cisco hardware, software, subscriptions, services and third-party products on one contract, interest-free. Any Cisco project from €1,000. Don't believe us? Over 3,000 EasyLease deals are closed per year across EMEA. To hear more, visit intelligentit.ie.
I can see why so many teams and sports organizations like this message, because it creates a sense of we're going to be aggressive in our game plan and we're going to attack whatever happens next, regardless if you're on, if you have the ball or if you don't have the ball, if you're defending or if you're attacking. It's like, okay, everybody, if they have this commitment to attack whatever the play is.
Yeah, I think John, just on the point that Joe's making. So there's a couple of things you say in the book. One is love tough. And one is, I think it's humble and hungry. Is that humble and hungry behaviours?
Yeah.
Can you just expand on those, just for people who are listening?
Yeah, well, what we're talking about here is the cultural level. We're talking about the team building level and the individual performance level. And that's where leaders must lead. We create a great culture. We build a great team. You have to be a connected team. And then we have to have each person performing at their highest level with optimism, with belief. So you really have to engage and affect all three levels of a team and organization. And that's what great coaches, great leaders like Stuart do. So love tough is just one of these examples where instead of tough love, I believe in love tough. And love tough is really what makes a great team. You combine love and accountability together. So we are accountable to each other, to a set of standards, but love must come first. And if love comes first, the more we have a relationship, the more we're connected, the more committed we will be. This is probably my biggest area of my work with teams now, is to help them become connected. Because I know, and we know, the more connected you are as a team, the more committed you will be to each other, the more you will fight for each other. But you don't get that from tough love. Andy Stanley said, rules without relationship lead to rebellion. So you can't have rules that make a team tough. You can't have just grinding on each other all the time and like really irritating each other. No, you got to love each other, develop a relationship, really commit together, and then you will fight for each other. A great example is, I don't know if you guys follow Australian rules football, but the Richmond team won this year. The Richmond team won for the first time in 36 years. Well, they read you win in the locker room first as well, and they did the hero hardship highlight exercise, the Triple H exercise, as a way to connect. They attribute, there's a big article in a magazine down there, I was actually on a radio show there talking about it. They attribute that exercise to bringing them so close together, becoming so connected, really developing a love for each other because they got to know each other's story. Guys were really just bawling. Like these tough, strong guys were literally breaking down, crying, sharing their story. But from there, that vulnerability, they became a connected, committed team. They wound up winning a championship, first time in 36 years. So there's power in love tough. And again, love tough says, we're going to love each other, but we're going to push each other. We're going to challenge each other to get better. So this is not like, oh, let's just love each other and just get along, be a great family. No, we're here to be a great team. So we're going to love each other. We're going to push each other, challenge each other to get better, to improve, to raise our standards and our expectations to be the best that we can.
Yeah. Can you explain to the people listening what you meant by the three H's? Because I think it's a really good strategy for people and teams to build those connections that you describe.
Yeah, I do this in corporate teams. You know, I work a lot with corporate teams. It's probably where I make most of my money and my living. You know, sports teams don't pay a lot. And so I work a lot with corporate teams, and it works just as effective there. We did it the other day. But you have each person go around on the team, and they share who is their hero. Like, who's your hero? A hardship that you faced, a defining moment in your life that made you who you are today. So what's the hardship? And then what's a highlight in your life that you feel proud of or that really makes you light up. A lot of people say the birth of their child or they got married or, you know, a great game they had, a great moment that helped them realize that they could do this, whatever it might be. But when you start to hear these stories, incredible. I mean, it's just so powerful what happens when a team does this. You can do this with your family. You do it with a group of friends. You do it with your work team, a sports team. Just so powerful. I have a lot of friends who are Navy SEALs. You know, they're in the armed forces. They do a lot of work with professional teams. A lot of teams in the States now bring in these Navy SEALs to work with them for team building. And they do these exercises where you jump in the water, the ice cold water. And I joke with my Navy SEAL friends, like, I don't believe you have to almost drown together to become I really believe you get connected by being vulnerable and really get to know each other.
Yeah, no.
So that's the practical stuff that people can actually do to try and build culture, because we keep talking about have a good culture, but that has to be worked on again. That has to be, there has to be practical things that people can take from listening to this and go, okay, well, there's an exercise that we could do. What else can people actually do to make sure that a culture is honest and that it does have integrity and that you do have a freedom to challenge your co-workers and your teammates in a way that isn't going to automatically lead to a fight if it's a training ground or, you know, recriminations if it's a workplace?
I think there's a great book, actually, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, by a guy, Patrick Lencioni, I think he is. And that's a story about a CEO who goes into an organization and she basically changes the culture of the organization. And the bottom layer where she felt was broken was the absence of trust. And what she does is rebuild the team with trust. I think we've talked about this before where, you know, as the leader of the organization or the leader of the team, you're the first person who has to be able to earn the trust of the people that you're leading and display that vulnerability. So, you know, doing the exercise that John's just described, I think it'd be brilliant if the head coach or the leader goes first and you open yourself up with the team and then they... And they can see that you can be trusted, and you know. And there's lots of different things that we've done to try and create connections between each other and to the team. And one thing I did with the England team was I wrote to the parents of the players and asked them to write back to me about what does it mean to see your son play for England. And I asked them to write to five different people who'd help their son become that England player.
Wow!
And I did it without the players knowing. I basically said, "Listen," and I said to the parents in this letter, "Listen, we all have to do this because if, you know, if Johnny doesn't get his letter back, then I can't give them all out and he's left there without his, So anyway, they all sent their email responses in and it was, you know, it was parent followed by grandparent, followed by a primary school teacher, followed by brother, followed by girlfriend. So they all came back in, 30-odd players, five different things each that basically said, this is what it means to see you, you know, how proud we are of you and what you've achieved. And it was incredibly, incredibly powerful. And anyway, so I had them all put them onto certificates and put them into A4 envelopes. And we had a guest speaker came into the team and he spoke about playing for his country. And another guy came in who'd fought for his country. He talked about that. And I showed this motivational video about the players playing at their best and what a great team we've become. And I said, "Oh, I've written to your parents." And they all looked at me as if to say, "You've done what?" And I gave them all their certificates in an envelope sealed. And during the course of the evening, I could see them one by one opening them and just watching their reactions. Some, you know, obviously visibly moved to tears. And it was probably the most significant moment in the development of the connection between each other and the team and the reason why we were all going to work hard for this particular team. The footnote, which I never realised had happened, my wife had done the same for me without me knowing. So wow. She had written to all my friends from primary school, secondary school, university, people I played rugby with. So there's a lot more than five, and people I taught at school with, and what it meant for them to see me coaching the England team. And so I didn't realise this happened. My PA came up to me at the end of the evening and said, "Oh, there's some paperwork for you to have a read when you get in." So I was lying on my bed about 2 o'clock in the morning, absolutely exhausted. You know, you've committed so much emotional energy to this event to try and get everyone in the right place and connect with each other and connect to the cause. And I opened this envelope and I was like, "What's this?" And anyway, then I'm sat there for like an hour thinking, "Oh my God, you know, this is incredible." So yeah, that was... if you stop from the day job and you pause to think creatively, how can we create better connections with each other? then it's actually not that hard to do. But the difficulty is stopping from answering the email, answering the phone, getting on with the day job. It's actually buying yourself time to think about ways we can connect. And often, you know, I often say to the coaches who work alongside me, let's get out of our laptops and let's get on the gym floor and just go and talk to them and say, what's happening at home? How's your day been? And you know, gradually, I mean, Wayne Smith, the New Zealand coach, he talks about a connection being like an invisible cord between me and the player. And the more you connect with people, the thicker the cord grows. So eventually you connect with all the players in your team. It's a bit like a spider's web if you're looking down on top and the cords are getting thicker and thicker. And, you know, if you feel that you haven't connected with that player, then you go back to them and just come in for just 5 minutes. Let's have a coffee, see how you're getting on. And often it's nothing more than that. You know, you can do the exercise like John's described, but it's often just the little conversations to show that you care.
And I want to add to that. I think that's brilliant what you shared, Stuart. And it's really about one-on-one connection. So what I encourage teams to do is just seek out one person a day, to have a meaningful connection with on your team. Yeah. Some conversation, communication. Who haven't you connected with? And seek out that person that day. Yeah. And if everyone on the team is doing that every day, because I might find one guy, another guy finds another guy, whatever it may be, you're going to have that meaningful connection over time. That's going to have a powerful impact. But I, like you said, it has to be practical. And we have to find ways to do it. The other thing we have to do is make sure we have a difficult conversation. Our friend Michael Gervais, who works for the Seahawks, Pete Carroll instituted Tell the Truth Mondays. Mm. And Tell the Truth Mondays is every Monday after a Sunday game, we get together and talk about what went wrong. Like, what went right? What went wrong? What can we learn from that? How can we get better? And so you have to have the difficult conversations as well as a team. And Michael, what he tells us is you have to really come together and say, this is how we do things. This is our culture. This is how we have difficult conversations. This is how we deal with emotionally charged issues. This is how we're going to confront them. And when we do that as a team, we have these difficult conversations. We talk about the tough issues. We grow closer from that.
Scheduling is actually a practical thing. The making it be Monday where you have that honesty. Like, I guess, you know, because obviously we're talking here about big organizations and big teams and team ethics, but finding the individual space as a manager, whatever your job is, to actually get the brain space to go, I need to have that individual connection with somebody. It's like almost a timetable or a refresher course for yourself in the middle of your day job.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the challenge of being a leader. You know, I found it a huge challenge. There were so many relationships and connections that I was trying to maintain, like spinning plates, not just within the team, within the board and the club country relationship and the media and commercial partners. And, you know, and as John said, you know, you've got your wife and your kids and all those connections, and your friends who want, you know, to be part of what you're doing. So it's actually emotionally and mentally draining, you know. So you've got to make sure you look after yourself. You know, I would get to bed early just so I had the energy to go again. And it's the scheduling. It's the Tell the Truth Monday. It's the same as a review for us, you know, in a rugby context. You know, we play a game Saturday. We have a Monday morning review. And I'm very cautious sometimes to, you know, if there's players, you know, if there's been an error made and a certain player, you know, is responsible, you know, I'd always try and pull them first and say, listen, I'm going to bring this up, but I'm not making it personal because, you know, we need to do it for the betterment of the team. And they'll always go, no, it's fine, coach. You don't worry about it. You know, so as long as you do it in the right way, you can have those moments with the moments of intimacy with the team. And they are very private. And, you know, the where you have that meeting, how you have that meeting, what you say in that meeting sets the tone for the week. And you've got to get it right. You've got to get it right as a coach. And If you get it wrong on a consistent basis, then you lose credibility in the eyes of the people that you're leading, and ultimately you lose the dressing room. So you talk about win the dressing room, you lose the dressing room if you get that bit wrong.
John, have you found that it's the philosophy that you have, it actually needs to be embraced across all levels of the organisation, that people can kind of pick and choose a little bit from various sources, and that unless actually you commit to a single continuous stream of thinking and philosophy, that you can be a bit confused in the messaging?
Yeah, it's called alignment. You really have to have alignment from the ownership, the GM, the coach, and the team. If you're talking about a company, CEO, the leadership team of the CEO, the managers, the employees. So we have to create alignment where everyone is embracing the shared vision and a greater purpose. They also have a shared belief of what we're here to do and why we're here to do it. And then there's this coming together to work together as one team, one united team, one organization. I interviewed Alan Mulally. Alan Mulally turned around Ford in 2006, and Ford was very scattered, very regionalized, numerous teams instead of one team. So he is the leader, CEO, the new CEO of Ford, came in and said, we have to become one Ford with one team, one plan, one goal. Everyone has to know the plan, embrace the plan, and relentlessly work towards the plan. Incredible advice. They were losing $14 billion. He had them profitable in a few short years. One of the greatest leadership feats in history of any kind, people say. He accomplished that. And that's what we have to do at all.
Have you seen teams turn it around when they've lost dressing rooms? Is it possible for coaches to get a dressing room back after they've lost it?
Oh, wow. Only if they have the difficult conversation. You know, Stuart talked about Patrick Lencioni's book, Five Dysfunctions. Patrick's a great friend. Yeah, you have to have me going to talk about the dysfunctions and how we can get better from them. But if you're willing to accept what went wrong and what we could do better and what we can change, and a team could do that and have that raw conversation, yes. Otherwise, if there's egos, if people are defensive, if people are covering their own turf and their own future, you're done. I mean, look at these teams that have success, right? They have a lot of success, and then everyone wants to get paid more. Everyone starts to get in their ego. Everyone gets a little jealous of each other. And that team does not have sustained success as a result of that. We see it all the time in professional sports in the States. And it's one of the biggest challenges to sustain success. The world wants short-term success. Like, Stuart, we want you to succeed this year. We don't care how you do it. But to have a long-term success, you have to do things the right way to build a team the right way. The outside world doesn't always see that. So you actually have to go countercultural to what the world wants.
That's the hard part, isn't it?
Yeah, win in the short term and build for the long term.
Yeah, 100%. Do these two things which are actually opposite, really.
Yeah. And again, part of the challenge for me at the time was, so I think in my first international game in charge of England, we had 220 caps in the starting 15. So that's not many international caps. You know, when you compare it to maybe Ireland and England, who played the game recently, both would have had 700 odd, I would say. So we were always behind the eight ball in terms of experience. And, you know, I was focusing my energy on creating the connection internally, i.e. the players to players and coaches to coaches, but gaining the connection outwards to the RFU staff, to the wider grassroots rugby supporters of England, to the country, you know, trying to create that extended connection. And using different tools to do that. So, and then, you know, as soon as you get one defeat, you know, the pressure reins in from the media and you've got to hold your nerve. And, you know, there were definitely times during the 3 years towards the World Cup where I remember we lost against South Africa and Australia, and we had New Zealand the next game. And I knew that if we lost the New Zealand game, which was obviously highly likely given the fact they hadn't been beaten, I was under huge pressure going to the Six Nations, and all the work that we were doing would probably, the external pressure would really begin to tell on even the strong culture that we created. Fortunately, we beat the New Zealanders in that memorable game at Twickenham in 2012, and that bought us time then to grow the team. So you do need to win in the short term, and that's the pressure of international coaching in particular, because it's such a such a pressurized environment, and you only get maybe a week to prepare. You know, one of the challenges of international coaching as well is you bring players together from 12 different teams in England, and you've got to connect them together. So they are not bitter rivals, but they are rivals in terms of Leicester versus Bath versus Saracens versus Gloucester. And you've got to try and say, right, that you are connected to each other at your clubs, but now we're going to connect together, even though you're playing against each other. And you're all used to being number one for your club team, and now one of you is going to have to be number two for the international team, and one of you might have to be the number three. And that is a big challenge. And I think that's something that Ireland have done really well, where, you know, there's the interprovincial rivalry between Connacht and Ulster, Munster and Leinster, but they will put that to one side and they'll be good mates and connected playing for Ireland, But I don't think that's happened overnight. I think that's taken... I mean, you'd know this better than me.
Yeah, well, there was the famous meeting back in 2009. Yeah, there was a team meeting. Yeah, where Rob Kearney stands up and says, I think the Munster lads are more committed to playing for Munster than they are for Ireland. And everybody from Munster kind of has an inhale of breath and then goes, maybe you're right. And the peace breaks out afterwards. But it did require one of those...
all those conversations. Love tough, isn't it, John? Love tough.
Yeah, I love that. I love that they actually had that conversation.
It changed the course of Irish rugby history. Certainly, it brought us that Grand Slam and it brought us that unified, and it kind of showed them all what they could do. A couple of things strike me about that. Are you different now? Would you go back now? And because obviously John talks about we have to look inside, not outside. It was the outside pressure that was the most noticeable thing that you spoke about there when you talked about that. The first thing you talked about was the outside pressure after losing the two games.
Would I do any different?
Yeah. What have you learned that would actually, if you could tap yourself on the shoulder and go, don't do that?
Well, that's a good question. It is a good question. I think if I divided my job at the time into leadership management and coaching, coaching being the on-field day-to-day work with the players, leadership being the communication connection piece, you know, inspiring the vision, painting a pathway we're all going to go together, and then management being the day-to-day, week-to-week logistical running of the operation, let's call it, I wish I'd delegated more of the managerial stuff to other people. You know, I, in my mind, I was thinking, well, I'm quite good at this and can't really think of anyone else to do it, so I'll just do it. And in hindsight, the model that works in America, I mean, having been to now, you know, the Atlanta Falcons and seeing how the head coach GM relationship works, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that's the model I would have, where the GM is doing all the managerial stuff and the recruitment and the board and on all that. So you've got to do your media, except... but then you can concentrate your mind on leadership and coaching. And, you know, if I divided my time up as national coach, I would say 5% was coaching, 45% management, 50% leadership. And
you clearly love the coaching.
Yeah, I love the coaching, but equally I felt it's a bit like being a head teacher at a school. You end up becoming the head teacher and don't teach anymore. And when I've come back to Leinster, the beauty of this job now that I'm doing is that Guy used to be and Leo Cullen, you know, Leo do a lot of the leadership stuff, a lot of the managerial stuff. I don't have to do any managerial stuff.
Yeah.
I can do with the leadership bit, you know, trying to help Leo there and just the coaching. And that's the thing I would have I'd done differently.
John, when you were talking earlier about asking people not to look out and to look in, you know, the sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt us. That rhyme we teach kids, which they listen to and they go, what are you talking about? Every time somebody calls me a name, it hurts really badly. Like, you know, it's a be confident, stupid. Like, it's all these things that we tell ourselves. How do you get good at it?
You understand the truth and you know that those outside words are just words and they only bother you if you let it. Like, let's be honest. One time someone calls us a name and we're ready to fight. Another time they call us a name and we're like, yeah, whatever. We're in a good mood. We're going to a party. We're going to have lunch with the friends. We don't even deal with it. It's never the event. It's never the circumstance. It's important to understand the circumstance doesn't have power over you. It's always your state of mind in that moment. So the fact that it bothered you is just letting you know that your state of mind was lowered in that moment. There are times when the calls don't go your way during the game from the referees, right? And you get upset, right? There are other times that you don't bother. You just go next play. Was it the call? No, it's always your state of mind. If it was the call, it'd be 100%. If the traffic is what bothered you each time, and sometimes you're in a good mood during traffic, it would be the traffic if it was 100%. It's not the traffic. It's never the circumstance. It's always a state of mind. Once you understand that, there's tremendous power and you're recognizing that. And anytime something does bother you, it lets you know in that moment, oh, I'm looking outside, not inside. So it's actually a signal. It's a guide of where you're looking.
The New Zealand team have triggers. For one of them, I think it's like making a...
Grab the wrist, yeah.
Grab the wrist. Yeah. There's definitely others who talk about the colour of the carpet, whatever sport they're doing or whatever. It's like, oh, I'm not in the moment. What colour is the carpet? And they go, okay, this carpet, I don't actually know what colour the carpet is here. I can't tell. It's kind of a kind of charcoal, maybe. Are there triggers for people that you teach when you're dealing with sports teams to go, okay, I'm looking outside, I need to look in?
No, I don't really. I mean, sports psychologists may do that. For me, it's not really the trigger. It's just letting them know your feelings are your guide. Like any moment you feel fear, if you're feeling fear and worried, that's a guide. If you have a negative thought, that's a guide. Here's what I know. Would you ever choose to have a negative thought?
I don't think so. No.
No.
You don't think so.
I'm pretty sure I wouldn't.
Who would ever choose to have a negative thought? No one would ever choose one. So why would we blame ourselves for the negative thoughts? Those thoughts come in, but you don't have to believe the negative thought. So what I tell people is when those negative thoughts are coming in, you do have a choice. Don't believe those negative thoughts. Fear is a liar. Fear will always lie to you. Don't believe the lies. Instead, know the truth. And the truth is, you were great yesterday, you can be great today. The truth is, you've been great in your career, you'd be great right now. The truth is, there's greatness inside of you. You have a desire to be great because there's a feeling in you that knows that you, that greatness is a potential of yours. So you keep on working towards that. So what I help athletes do, I help people of all types do is understand not to believe the lie, don't allow the negativity in. Instead, you feed that positive thought. So my best advice is to talk to yourself instead of listen to yourself. If you listen to yourself, you hear all the negative, the fear, and the doubts. But if you talk to yourself, you can feed yourself with the words and the encouragement you need to keep on moving forward. I got this from Dr. James Gills. He's the only person on the planet to complete 6 double Ironman triathlons, which means you do an Ironman and 24 hours later you do another one. And the last time he did, he was 59 years old. 59 the last time he did it. So he told me that his secret was I talk to myself instead of listen to myself.
Well, that's not a bad piece of practical advice to finish up on. John, if anybody wants to get on the course of your books, what's the best starting point? Bear in mind that the audience here is very sports orientated. So is you winning the locker room first not a bad starting point?
I would actually start with the energy bus because that's the one that's been read by, you know, hundreds of thousands of coaches and leaders, you know, around the world. So I would start with the energy bus because that's the foundation. And then I would read You Win in the Locker Room after that. And then I would go to The Power of Positive Leadership.
Good stuff.
Now, listen, John, really appreciate your time. I know you're a very busy man. So, you know, we're very privileged to have you on here. And, you know, hopefully if you come to Ireland again at some point, I'll still be here. Drew will be here and we'll have a Guinness together.
I would love that. And really, I'm honored to be with you guys. And I have to tell you, when I was in Ireland, my wife is Irish. She's a Carol. So my wife is a Carol. And when we were in Ireland, I just felt like that was my place. I'm like, these are my people. My wife's like, not Irish. I am. I go, yeah, but they're my people. I just really felt at home there. One of my favorite places on earth was Dublin. I just loved it. So, you know, just thanks so much for having me. And I will be back. So look forward to seeing you.
The energy vampire, it's a concept I like the idea of. We all know plenty of them.
Fortunately, there's not many.
No.
There isn't many. I think, you know, they stand out. If you get the culture right, they stand out. And usually the culture and the environment means that they either change their behaviours to not be an energy vampire.
Yeah.
And be an energy giver. And if not, then they need to move on.
Yeah. And look, the thing is, right, sport has short contracts and also has the ability to trade people in a way that most work environments are like, we're going to have to HR this situation through a long period of annoying meetings. But
I do get that, but even so.
Yeah, but I think the culture change, and you isolate people by having a good culture, and people are outside that then feel like they either have to change or they move on, and people get the message pretty quickly. That positivity isn't something that always sits well with Northwestern Europeans like us. We're always very skeptical of the energy of Americans like that, but you can see why sports teams are like, well, if we can just get everybody on the same the same buzz here.
Yeah, and I think you know, John's message is, when you read his books, it is a very simple message. You know, the books aren't complex, and you know, I've read a lot of leadership books, and his were good. They were practical. They made sense. He talks about communicate, to connect, to commit. And, you know, even if you just remembered that, you wouldn't go far wrong. Communicate well with the people in your organisation from top to bottom. Connect with them. So find that time during the day to spend time, or do the 3 H's exercise, or whatever it is to get to know each other a bit better. Go out for a few beers, whatever it is, you know, whatever it takes. Build those bonds, and then you get the commitment that you need. And I think it starts with the leader. And I think that's the point John makes.
Stuart Christoph.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Leaders Questions with Stuart Lancaster. I hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is brought to you by Cisco Systems and Exertis Ireland. An EasyLease 0% project is easy to calculate. Simply take your total Cisco project cost and divide it by 36. That's the amount you'll pay every month. Don't believe us? Yes, it's interest-free financing. To hear more, visit intelligentit.ie. And make sure you subscribe to all the rest of our podcasts. And we'll be back with another one next week. Good luck.
Leaders Questions. Thanks to Cisco Systems and Exertis Ireland. Providing a secure, intelligent platform for digital business. Visit intelligentit.ie.